We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
You're listening to 95.7 The Game, KGMZ FM and HD1 San Francisco, a radio.com sports station.
Peter, I'm sure you've known Ray long enough to understand that his favorite sporting event is a quick one. Second fastest playoff game this decade in real time. The Niners making mincemeat of the Vikings. Holding Dalvin Cook to 9 attempts is just... we sit around trying to think of all the things that might happen in any game. I never thought that Dalvin... I would have bet my life, even in the worst-case scenario, Dalvin Cook's getting at least 15 carries in this game. Where did it go wrong? I mean, 7-3 and outs is pretty hard to overcome.
My feeling is that, you know, the 49ers played great along the front, but I also think that the Vikings just, look, I like Kirk Cousins. I'm still not convinced he's a big-time player, but I like him. I think he's an above-average quarterback, but in that game, you got to be... You know, if you're watching the Russell Wilson game last night, at some point you just said, damn it, if this guy gets the ball again with 2 minutes to go, the Seahawks are going to win. Do you ever get that feeling with Kirk Cousins at any point in that game that he was going to beat the 49ers?
No.
I just didn't. And that, to me, your quarterback has to make some plays that he shouldn't make. And Kirk Cousins just didn't do that in that game. And I just think he didn't give his team a chance to win.
But is that a reasonable standard? Because I can think of only five quarterbacks for whom that would be real, and maybe even just four. I mean, at some point, if you don't have one of those four guys, you have to figure out ways to win with a pretty good quarterback who might not be able to make that play.
But, Ray, if you look at the way Tennessee played the other night, okay, Ryan Tannehill made two fantastic throws. The throw to Khalif Raymond, the long throw where he made the diving catch in the end zone for the touchdown against a very, very good secondary. Eric DaCosta, the GM of the Ravens, has decided to build by spending a lot of money on the secondary and letting good pass rushers like Za'Darius Smith go. And so you don't have to be one of the four best quarterbacks in football to make games more competitive than they should be. In that game the other day, I just didn't trust Cousins to make enough plays. In the game that they won, that Tennessee won, Ryan Tannehill made two huge throws. And, you know, those are the kind of throws that if you're going to win a big, big playoff game, in my opinion, that is the kind of thing you need to do. You need to make those sort of very, very big throws. Cousins just didn't do it.
As we figure out the postmortem on the Seahawks, I mean, won't they be remembered as this? There's no team who was better in 2019 at hanging around a game they probably didn't belong in.
Well, true, but I think the biggest thing about the Seahawks that occurs to me is that I just think they really, really overachieved. When I look at this team, I just think of a team that John Schneider built a really, really good one for 1 year. He made some fantastic moves. The Jadeveon Clowney move for a third-round pick and paying only half his salary was utterly fantastic. But at the end of the day, they just simply relied on Russell Wilson too much to be a magician.
How many points do you think minimum Green Bay has to produce to win this game? And I don't mean a shootout, but I mean how many times do they have to get the better of San Francisco's defense realistically to win the game without saying, well, the 49ers have to give up the ball four times?
I mean, my guess would be they got to score 24 points, absolute minimum. I can't imagine the 49ers not putting up more than that. But I think they've got to score three or four touchdowns to win this game.
24 points, Peter, feels like a great way to start a game unless you're Bill O'Brien. What did we learn from that defeat?
You know, I thought it was very curious how, and look, Bill O'Brien obviously did not have a good day. But let's be a little bit realistic. I think in this let's blame somebody society, people will conveniently blame Bill O'Brien for the loss by Houston. I think that is categorically, absolutely stupid. You know, because players play. And I agree. I never in a million years from your own 21-yard line up, whatever they were, 17 points, I never in a million years would have called a fake punt on fourth and four. That was totally irresponsible. Even if they made it, I would have said, what in the world are you doing? But I think the other part of it is this is a defense that has struggled all year to stop anybody. And it's not Bill O'Brien's fault that their defense allowed seven consecutive touchdown drives. I wish I had a great database to figure out whether anyone, any defense has ever done that before. It probably has happened, but I certainly don't remember it. That just absolutely was, that's why they lost the game. They didn't lose the game because Bill O'Brien made a couple of dumb calls, or at least one call in the second quarter. But it makes a good headline and all that stuff. It's just, I just think it's a little bit unrealistic to think that Bill O'Brien's dumbness in the second quarter cost him the game. It didn't.
Peter King joining us on Damon Ratto and Kolsky. Kolsky's out sick today. We got to get to the year of Lamar, which it really was around the NFL, but that year will not go any further into the playoffs as the Ravens are now heading home. And so many people are trying to reframe, which is probably ridiculous after just four quarters of football, who Lamar Jackson is. I don't think there's any indictment on him. The indictment should be possibly on option football, which, I mean, the Ravens were glorious front runners, which sounds like an insult, mm-hmm. but it's the right way to describe it, is it not?
What killed the Ravens the other night, in my opinion, was two things. Number one, their power running game was invisible because Mark Ingram was invisible. And this year, I bet there have been 15 times where for two series, Mark Ingram banged his head against a wall early in the game, and the Ravens just stuck with the run. And then at some point, Ingram and that very strong run-blocking offensive line just wore teams down. And Ingram wasn't Ingram the other night. His calf injury was much worse than the Ravens ever said. So you add that with the fact that, you're right, they were not a good team to play come from behind with. And I think the one other factor in this game that nobody is talking about is the fact that, and this is going to be a factor this week too, okay? Everybody's talking about, oh, Derrick Henry, Derrick Henry, Derrick Henry. The Tennessee secondary is damn good, even without Malcolm Butler. And they have made huge plays against the Patriots and huge plays against Baltimore. And you could see, you know, after about three series, you could see how frustrated Lamar Jackson was because he wasn't finding open receivers downfield and he didn't have the running game to take the pressure off him. So, you know, I'm not saying it was predictable. I never would have predicted that outcome, but I don't think it was absolutely stunning. And I think that in terms of Lamar Jackson and learning things, he really needs to have, I don't, this, he's got to have some adversity in his life. He hasn't had a lot either in his college or pro career. And I think this game really in this end of year situation, the last 2 years, is going to help him grow as a player.
How much of that then is the fact that not having Ingram, they didn't consider Gus Edwards a more viable option so that Jackson isn't running the ball 20 times and throwing it 59?
Yeah, I mean, Jackson really to me is a, even though he's a bigger guy, he's more of a slasher running back. Ingram is a pounder. And even though Tennessee has a big front, Jarrell Casey's one of the best and least known players in football, I think they needed to pound their head against Tennessee and try to wear them out early in this game. And without Ingram there to do it consistently, they just were unable to have that element of their game.
Peter, Kyle Shanahan, I think, won twice, because not only did he win the game, he gets to keep his coordinator in Robert Saleh.
Yeah.
I understand that an offensive mind for Baker Mayfield would be what you'd want if you were the Cleveland Browns. To me, though, one was so pantsed by the other. Would you have still gone with Stefanski with a bullet after you just saw what Saleh and the unit did to Stefanski's game plan, which bordered on uncreative?
I mean, the reason that his game plan, I thought, was uncreative is that it was 2nd and 9, 2nd and 10, 2nd and 11 all the time. And, you know, because they could never do anything on early downs. And look, when you have zero first downs rushing, that tells you, and all of the pressure on the quarterback. You know what the Vikings did this year that people don't talk about nearly enough? Last year, Kirk Cousins threw 606 passes. This year, they went into this season saying, essentially, we are going to take the pressure off Kirk Cousins and we're going to run it a lot more. He threw the ball 150 less times. He threw the ball 10 times less per game, 9 or 10, whatever the number is. And so now you get to this game, and now you can't play the way you've played the entire year. That's unnerving. It's absolutely unnerving. And you know, let me answer your question directly. Look, I don't know the substance of any of the interviews that happened, but all I know is that if last Wednesday or Thursday, maybe let's say last Thursday, after they meet with Josh McDaniels, and either because they're convinced that McDaniels is not the guy or McDaniels tells them that he's not going to exist in their system as it exists, if they've decided that they're down to Saleh and Stefanski, well, I'm certainly not going to let a 60-minute football game change my mind if we have decided by last Thursday or Friday that Stefanski's our guy. And I understand that you watch that game and you say, how in the world did you pick Stefanski? I get it. But, I think you would need to be involved in the process and know everything that happened rather than say, how can you hire the coordinator of the team that was awful in the playoffs instead of the coordinator of the team that dominated them? I get that reaction, but I just don't think it's realistic because you don't really know what happened when each of those guys met with that team.
Well, then let's say this much. They probably announced it at the wrong time for the backlash that they got. But the question I actually want to ask is,
they didn't announce it. It was somebody broke it. Okay. And the Browns specifically have not announced it, and they aren't going to announce it till sometime this week. But anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, I think at this point it's naive to expect that you can keep a secret when agents mm-hmm. and family members have access
right.
to the media like
yeah.
everybody else. Yeah. But more to the point, with the strictures they've put on Stefanski or whoever they were going to hire to make sure that he turned in his game plan on Friday to mm-hmm. Jimmy Haslam and the analytics people, and then meet on Saturday After the game plan is allegedly put away to meet with the analytics people again on Saturday, it sounds to me like Robert Saleh got the better end of this deal by not getting the job.
I can tell you, I know a few things about the interview process and what has been requested. And I can tell you the vast majority of coaches in the NFL, other than, not vast majority, the majority of assistant coaches in the NFL would have either severely chafed at the restrictions that are going to be put on a coach there, or simply wouldn't have taken the job. I believe that, you know, and I have no idea what Robert Saleh thinks of the process. Maybe he's all in favor of this being involved in the Billy Beane experiment coming to football. I can't answer that, but I do know that the Cleveland Browns are going to be the most interesting team in football this year because everybody goes into it with the thought that Kevin Stefanski took a deal that a clear majority of strong candidates to be head coaches would not have taken.
Peter, I don't know if Marshawn Lynch created much of an impact or difference on the field for the Seahawks. It was the play he wasn't on the field where they got the penalty that we all know about that he might have made his biggest impact until he reached the podium last night for a post-game goodbye, maybe his final walk-off. He doesn't do a lot at the podium. I'd like to play 24 seconds and then ask you a question about it.
Now, I done been on the other side of a retirement, and it's good when you get over there and you can do what the you want to. So I tell y'all right now while y'all in it, take care of y'all bread. So when y'all done, you go ahead and take care of yourself. So while y'all at it right now, take care of y'all bodies. You know what I mean? Don't take care of y'all chicken. You feel me? Don't take care of y'all mentals because, look, we ain't lasting that long.
Peter, my question is, shouldn't Marshawn Lynch essentially be a one-man rookie symposium?
Hey, look, first of all, let's say one thing about Marshawn Lynch. And I know people are minimizing his impact, but let's just say this one thing. He came off the street and suited up for three games for the Seattle Seahawks. Big, big, big games. And he scored four touchdowns. So Marshawn Lynch was a factor for the Seahawks. And I believe if he comes back, if he chooses to come back, somebody, and you know, depending on what happens, I think somebody would sign him for next year. You know, Marshawn is probably one of the most complicated characters I've ever seen in the NFL, because late in his Seattle career, where he was really, really unhappy, he was a divisive figure inside the Seahawks.
Yeah.
And I'm quite impressed that John Schneider and Pete Carroll said, let's bring him back to try to help save our season, because they were not sad to see him go when he left. But I do think that the valuable stuff he said last night, talking to players on their level, I had to look in Urban Dictionary about what chicken meant. And
just watch your money. Watch what takes care of
yeah,
you.
Of course. Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of exaggerating, but I did look it up. But I think, you know, last night Mike Silver wrote about this. I'm kicked off that I didn't see it because I was writing about a lot of the same stuff. And Silver saw this. I just didn't see it. There's genuine affection between Marshawn Lynch and Aaron Rodgers. They only played together for 1 year at Cal, I think 2004. But the affection that they showed each other after the game that Mike documented so well in his story was really shows how much respect he has, not necessarily just from the running back fraternity or, you know, from his own team, but from players around the league. So I think it'd be great if 1 year or maybe multiple years, the NFL gets him up on stage for the symposium. And quite honestly, I'm probably going to steal that idea in my column and say next week they ought to have him at the rookie symposium every year. I mean, how do you like my great idea?
Hey, feel free to cite a source or spell the name right, whatever you got to do, Peter. Okay, so I, look, we have we've been talking to you for 40 minutes here. This is you have more than given at the office for sure today. But as a huge baseball fan, I got to ask you about the seismic shift of the earth moving underneath the Houston Astros with the decision to let Ludnow and Hinch go today. Do you think that the fault line will reach all the way to Alex? Who is the opening day manager of the Boston Red Sox next year, Peter?
I don't know, but it's not going to be Alex Cora.
It's the correct answer.
He may never manage the Red Sox again, or maybe anybody. I mean, I had no idea it was as big a deal as it was. I mean, when something happens in the middle of the football season, I don't pay all that much attention to it.
Right.
I mean, I've read about it. I understood it. I read the Athletic story with Mike Fiers. And obviously, wow, that was an incredible story. But the one thing I would say about this story that makes it really, really different is that from the sounds of it and from the reporting of it, you absolutely, if you could adjust very quickly, maybe even while the pitcher was in his was in his motion, if you could adjust to that, that's a gigantic factor to know what pitch is coming. And I'd love to know the Red Sox in 2018 and the Astros in 2017. I would love to know some of those big hits that each team had down the stretch and in the playoffs, in the World Series, how much of that was helped by knowing what was coming. And I was slightly surprised, because when this all was done, I said, how can they not vacate the World Series? You know, I thought on the team side that they really might do something like that. And look, I'm not smart enough about baseball to know whether this is excessive, just right, or whatever. I do know this. I think A.J. Hinch is a hell of a manager. I really have a lot of admiration for him as a baseball person. And I know it's way, way too early, but I hope he hasn't managed his last game. He just seems like a good person, good human being, good head on his shoulders, great baseball guy. I hope he can rehab his image and get back in the game at some point.
Peter, thank you so much, man. You know what? Take the rest of the night off. Thank you.
Hey, thanks a lot, guys. Really appreciate it.
Thank you, Peter King, here on 95.7 The Game on a Monster Monday, brought to you by Benjamin Moore Paints. Paint like no other. And by Dolan's Lumber, Windows, and Doors. Look, we got so much coming up all week long as we get you ready for the NFC title game. I want to encourage you to download the Radio.com app. We've got it all covered all week long leading up to the NFC Championship game. You can listen to us on the go, at work, anywhere your smartphone is, we are. Download the Radio.com app, favorite 95.7 The Game. Boom. You get to listen to the show no matter where you go. So, an awful lot gone over there with Peter King. What stood out?
He was hard at work equivocating for everybody. I thought that he would come down harder on Bill O'Brien, because the thing that basically dominated that game was the fact that he wouldn't take the chance when it would have benefited him the most, but took the chance when it had a chance to harm him the most.
Yeah.
And I know that second-guessing coaches is too easy for too many people who understand way too little about football, but those are just obvious because they happen in the same game and they happen in exactly the opposite order of what win probability would tell you to do. And coaches have to know win probability now. They have to. It is a necessary part of their tool belt. And the fact that he did that in just the opposite ways, in some places, might have gotten him fired. Because it's too obvious. I mean, you're not going to get chances to be up four scores on a team in the postseason enough. And backing away from a chance to just crush the game, I don't believe is anything that Matt LaFleur would do, or Kyle Shanahan would do, or John Harbaugh would do, or guys who have, you know, shown that they get it tactically. And that was one of the things that jumped out at me. The other thing is that I think he views the Packers as a formidable contender with the single exception of the one thing that's ultimately going to destroy them, which is their offensive line, because that's been the one failing they've had all year. And I think that's going to reveal itself on Sunday, just because I don't know that they're that much better now than they were back then.
I would agree with you. And outside of when you look at how everything fell, you got the one seed of the overall dance bounced with the best record leaving in the Ravens. So if the Niners reach the Super Bowl, are they the automatic? They're automatically wearing red, or do we now flip a coin for who's the home team, who's the away team?
You mean in the Super Bowl?
In the Super Bowl.
I think that is predetermined.
All right.
And it's predetermined not by I'm speaking out of ignorance, so let's fly. I think that is predetermined based on who wore the home jersey the year before. I think they alternate, but I can't say that for sure.
Well, if the one seed can choose the color, the highest remaining seed is now the 49ers, which officially means that everything you might have wanted to happen broke in your direction. We will look at the playoffs from the 35,000 feet angle and how really everything broke the 49ers away, with maybe the exception of, sure, you would have liked to seen Patrick Mahomes go no further, take your chance with, you know, Houston if you get to them.
Yeah, you could have taken the next 2 weeks off. 3 weeks.
Outside of that, there really could not have been a better day and weekend of breaks. We're going to go over that. We're going to come on back, and we will get to Richard Sherman. Stay frosty, Richard, no matter what. All of that's coming up, including your calls in our final segment. 888-957-9570 is the number. Damon Ratto and Kolsky on 95.7 The Game.
Damon Ratto and Kolsky continues on 95.7 The Game.
Good to have you along this afternoon, man. The 49ers got the job done. They got it done convincingly. They got it done overwhelmingly. It was quite the opening salvo from Kyle Shanahan and his coaching staff in their first playoff game together. Jimmy Garoppolo's first playoff game was not an overwhelming afternoon. He was incredibly average in his first career playoff game. And it won't matter how average he is, if this defense comes and plays like that, 7 3-and-outs in an afternoon of football. The last time the 49ers had 7 3-and-outs in an afternoon of playoff football, that was the last time they were in the Super Bowl in 1995. There were 7 drives that the Chargers had that day that revealed no first down in the drive. And it's just, it's one of the more overwhelmingly lopsided Super Bowls you're going to find. Steve Young had an afternoon. You don't need Steve Young, though, when you're pitching shutouts like that over and over again.
Well, they probably didn't need Steve Young that day either because, again, first downs, which we never really cite as an important truth, can be put in the right context. And when you can't make a first down, you're fried. And that's sort of what happened, you know, to Minnesota. But it also happened that the fact they couldn't run the ball, that they became one-dimensional, that the 49ers defensively had one breakdown in 50 plays. I mean, I don't know what else. I mean, it was your standard comprehensive beatdown that a one seed usually performs on a 6 seed.
You turned all music all the way down? Nah, I don't know why it's still up. Thank you very much.
All right, I'll do that.
No, it's not you, Ray. Actually, so, there was a mistake on the show not made by you. Congratulations.
Well, then bite me.
The 49ers trying to, like, do the old play it again, Sam, routine. We're starting to line up with history here in a way that, like, maybe you should get nervous by all this. I don't know. Back in 1994 when the Niners won that Super Bowl, right now, guess what? Both were 13-3. Both were the one seeds in the NFC. The offensive coordinator then was Mike Shanahan. The offensive coordinator now is Kyle Shanahan. He's got another head coaching job, too. Where was the Super Bowl that year? Miami. Guess where it is this year? That's right. There was a fun patch 75-year anniversary patch. Remember the blue diamond big 75 patch on all the jerseys? Now you get your 100th anniversary patch. So you got special patches. 1994, meant Super Bowl. Let's see what it means now. Outside of Patrick Mahomes in an overwhelming offensive unit with a head coach who knows how to deploy it in Andy Reid, and Derrick Henry's thighs being redwoods, like, what's left? Is there anything that scares you about a single team unit, anything? I think the Niners are going to win the Super Bowl, Ray. I think they're going to, and I think they win the Super Bowl. The only thing that would scare me would be it was a bad afternoon defensively. Patrick Mahomes overwhelmed you, and Jimmy could not match Patrick Mahomes throw for throw, which is officially a tough thing to do. That to me feels like how they might lose a Super Bowl. Outside of that, if it were the Tennessee Titans, I think they beat the Tennessee Titans.
Well, I mean, it's hard to imagine a 6 seed running the table. But I think Kansas City could do what they do to people without your defense playing poorly. Sometimes they just play so well that you can't stop them. That's why they are the extraordinary offense they are. I mean, the 49ers are a different team than that, in that all their areas are really solid and really good. Kansas City has an offense that is otherworldly. I mean, it's light years more explosive than the 49ers. It's light years more explosive than anybody's because it has so many components to it. Good offensive line, great wide receivers. They have a running game that they don't really need that much, but it's effective enough. And Patrick Mahomes is a legitimate game changer in ways that the 49ers really don't have except for their tight end. And I would say if you wanted to stack up game-changing abilities, I'd take Mahomes before I'd take Kittle.
Yeah.
That said, I think it would be the only fascinating Super Bowl. Green Bay against either of them, I don't think is a fascinating match because I don't think Green Bay can defend either team. You can ask Aaron Rodgers to win a game single-handedly, and he's done that before. But I don't know that they're up for tackling Derrick Henry 35 times or trying to defend 45 Patrick Mahomes passes. And I think the 49ers would be genuinely up against it against Kansas City. I think it would be a great game. I don't think it would be a comfortable win at all. Tennessee, I think, would be a comfortable win because they don't do enough other than run the ball to make the 49ers a weak defense.
No disrespect to the Green Bay Packers, not for a second, but if styles make fights, what would be more interesting than the best passing defense than the Niners basically have ever had in franchise history going up against a premier passing offense to the point where the Chiefs don't even run the ball?
Well, they'd have to run it some.
It'd be staggering. What an afternoon that would be. What a Super Bowl Sunday. Yeah. I know what the networks are hoping for. Who's got the Super Bowl this year? Is it Fox?
Yes.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Fox is going to be in the rare position where they'll be rooting for the Packers to not make a Super Bowl because 49ers Chiefs would be the sexiest, easiest sell job there is to America's casual viewer. Love points.
Except for one thing. Aaron Rodgers moves the needle by himself. The 49ers do not have that guy, and we're just talking about TV ratings, not football acumen. The 49ers are they're a football fan's watch, but a casual fan knows Aaron Rodgers because he sells life insurance and because he's a familiar name and he's been there over and over and over again. And I think in some ways, Fox would get about the same number either way, but I think they would get a higher number if it was blank v. Kansas City than if it was blank v. Tennessee. Tennessee is the only team that I don't think Fox would want.
Right. Well, I mean, either way. I mean, your choice between the 49ers or the Packers to represent the NFC in the Super Bowl, what do you want? You want the staff or the orb? I mean, either way, it's a crown jewel.
That's what I'm saying. Yeah. It's that whether the 49ers get there or not, Fox will be fine on the NFC side. The only way this doesn't work for them, it seems to me, is if it's Tennessee, because you can't make Ryan Tannehill a casual fan's interest. And you'd have to work hard to make Derrick Henry a casual fan's interest, because Derrick Henry is all about power football. And really, there's sort of nothing else that's sort of been celebrity molded about his character or his personality. I mean, that would be a football thing. Patrick Mahomes is famous enough doing what he does that I think they would take either NFC team against Mahomes a lot faster than either NFC team against Tennessee. I think that's the only thing they don't want to see is X v Tennessee.
When we talked to Emmanuel Sanders last week, he said that Richard Sherman walked up to him and said, "I'm getting an interception today," and he did. Well, I don't know if Richard Sherman told him that about this past game, but Richard Sherman did.
Third and nine. Cousins fires over the middle, and it's intercepted at the 40-yard line by Richard Sherman.
Richard Sherman, a playoff interception, and that means you got to go to the podium. If Richard's going to the podium, you're going to want to make sure that you hit record. And he had frosty Richard Sherman for anyone who wanted a shake.
I get tired of hearing, "Oh, man, he's a zone corner." I get tired of hearing the excuses for why I'm great. It was man coverage. I covered the man. I picked the ball off. In the playoffs, in big games, I show up. I show up year in, year out, whether it's 2011, 2012, 2013, 2014. Unless I tear my Achilles, I'm out there and I'm doing my job at a high level. And I think I get tired of the excuses, you know, for why I'm good. "Oh, my God, they're playing zone. Oh, my God, it was this guy. Oh, my God, receiver slipped. Oh, my God." It's like, why don't other people get those ops then? You know what I mean? There's a lot of other corners out there who have the same ops I have. It's like people got frustrated that I was so confident early on in my career. I was so confident early on so that people wanted me to fail. And when I didn't fail, it's like, how do we tear him down in other ways? How do we find a way to tear him down? You know what I mean? How do we find a way to rip his game apart? Because I'm too consistent on a year-in, year-out basis. You know, since I got in the league, every category that matters to a corner, I'm number one in. Completion percentage, interceptions, touchdowns against, yards, completion percentage, passer rating. You know, if that was any other corner, it wouldn't even be a conversation. But, you know, I just get tired of it. You know, in the playoffs, I played in 13 games now. Zero touchdowns given up, three interceptions. Like, show me somebody else doing it like that. And then I'll enjoy the argument. You know what I mean? But there isn't.
That guy.
I don't think there's an argument.
One. They won the game. And he's that pissed off at the whole world still. We talked about this with Michael Irvin earlier. The chip on an athlete's shoulder is a thing that is easily removed by several factors that any successful athlete runs into. The comfort of, "I've already won, I've already proven it." The comfort of the mansion you live in, the clothes you wear, the accolades you received. The comfort of your legacy being secure before you set foot on the field once again. It can only get worse. It can't really get better. And Richard Sherman finds ways to stay pissed off in ways that I know a lot of people look at it and go, "Well, that's unnecessary. And why did he turn that frown upside down?" Because then he wouldn't be Richard Sherman anymore. And I just want to remind you that Michael Jordan was still dunking on people in his Springfield Hall of Fame acceptance speech. Some of these guys have to stay angry so they feel like themselves. And that's who Richard Sherman is.
Which I get. But I don't know anybody who's complaining that Richard Sherman is just a zone corner anymore.
He makes things up.
He makes things up. And that's the thing that I just, that's a head scratch for me. If he needs to do that for his own comfort level, fine. But I don't have to listen to it because he's a first team all pro. He's the one of the two best cornerbacks in football, indisputed. And whatever he needs to juice himself up, fine. I just don't have to listen because I don't believe any of it. What I believe is he's one of the two best guys in football at the thing he does. That is sufficient for me.
But you didn't believe he was going to do that until you were a doubting Thomas. You wanted to see it before you believed it, right?
I wanted to see it before I believed that he was the Richard Sherman of old, because he was not a bad player last year. and he was playing on a leg and a half. But with that injury at this time of his career, I don't think it was unreasonable to ask the question, is that all there is? Has he topped out? And it's clear that he didn't. And I don't feel bad about being wrong, because I've been wrong before and I'll be wrong again. I think he doesn't feel bad about telling you. And that's
fine. I told you were going to be wrong. And that's how he gets out of bed.
Which is fine, but it makes him not a fun companion in those parts of the day. And I also think that he would be exactly the same player if he wasn't pissed off, because I think he is such a student of the game and he is such a smart player that I don't believe he plays angry. He plays at being angry. I think he plays as smart a game of football as nearly any player in the sport, quarterbacks included. So if I think him being angry about perceived slights is show business to a certain extent. I think he's done everything you need to see from a player to acknowledge the fact that he's still great.
He's given up, and this is a season total, 17 catches on 34 targets, a grand total of 130 receiving yards, no touchdowns, two interceptions, a passer rating allowed of 35.2. He's allowed 10 receiving yards per game this year. Those are his coverage stats over the last 13 games this season. And remember, he had to pretend, or no, I don't say pretend, the famous George Costanza line. You know, Jerry, if you believe it, it's not a lie. There was video evidence that showed Baker Mayfield shook his hand after he said Baker Mayfield didn't shake my hand. If the ghosts aren't real, invent them if it makes you run faster on game day. And that's what I think the formula is for him. He will invent the ghost to chase him because he knows he's faster when being chased.
See, and I think that's all entertainment, because he knows how fast he needs to be. And he would be exactly that fast if he didn't make the ghost up. Because I think at his essence, he's an actor for us, but he's a professor for himself.
But I don't think he doesn't feel like he's looking to entertain anyone but on the football. I don't know, man. Like there's something that is, I think, genuine in how misplaced his anger is, that he believes it. And by the way, just if you needed another full circle moment here, you do realize that when the Niners host the Packers, it will be 6 years to the day that Richard Sherman picked off that sorry receiver, Michael Crabtree. 6 years to the day. Sports are beautiful.
Well, okay.
Sports are perfect. 888-957.
We just found out today how perfect sports aren't.
Oh, you mean the earth-shattering Major League Baseball story that we didn't have much of a chance to get into today, but throughout the week we'll absolutely be pivoting towards? Because good Lord, what I do know is that this town, the Bay Area, loves a baseball discipline story. I mean, Balco, Barry Bonds, we did it all out here. What happened today to the Houston Astros, who saw the day begin with their GM, Jeff Ludenow, and then their manager, A.J. Hinch, being suspended for a full year, which was a moment. Jim Crane, the Astros owner, then fires both those guys. They've been stripped of first and second round picks in this draft, the next draft, and you've never seen baseball come down harder on anything than they came down on the Astros today, stopping short of stripping them of wins and titles. They stripped them of all their dignity, that's for sure.
Yeah, the rarest thing about this is that they took off after management rather than players, because normally it's players who get it.
All players skated.
Yeah. And I think ultimately what we're going to find out is the dynamic in Houston was that Jeff Ludenow is the guy who wanted the system put in and agreed to it being put back in, or insisted on it being put back in. And A.J. Hinch ate one for the team here, and he ate a bad one, which is why I think ultimately he will be a manager again. But Jeff Ludenow will not be a general manager again. He may never work in baseball again, because I think, one, he's not well-liked within the fraternity. And by the fraternity, I mean people who do the hiring in this sport. And two, the explanations for how this happened all point to him. And they point to Hinch basically trying to stop it and then giving up when the monitors he kept breaking kept getting replaced. That's the general manager who does that.
Right. That's not the clubhouse guy.
No, it's not. So I think what we're going to have to find out now is whether baseball is going to be as draconian when it comes time to deal with the Boston Red Sox, because there's 4 weeks before spring training. And it does not sound like their investigation of the Red Sox is nearly as far along as the Astros one was. And the Astros one took forever. So they may be firing a general manager and a manager in the middle of the season unless baseball contrives a way to let them walk, in which case the message is there are teams we won't screw with and teams we will.
A's pitcher Mike Fiers is the guy who shot up the distress flare that something was wrong in Houston. That distress flare has turned itself into one of the more disciplinary-driven afternoons we've ever seen baseball hand down. I'm going to need a night, and I'm going to need at least 6 or 7 different articles to try to properly frame with historical perspective how unprecedented and precedented some of this stuff is. Basically, the last time we've seen a manager suspended for a full year was Leo DeRocher, and there was a gambling element involved there, and that was before your grandma ever decided that your parents were going to be around. Like, that was a real long time ago.
Yeah. George Steinbrenner got suspended for a year because he was a felon. Marge Schott got suspended because
she was a Nazi.
She liked to keep Nazi memorabilia in the front desk drawer to share with guests.
It's like Eddie Rickenbacker's over on 2nd Street. There used to be some real weird paraphernalia behind that bar.
Yeah. But for the most part, baseball has always been very good at punishing players and lousy at punishing management. This was a punishment aimed at management. And the fact that they basically ignored two of the coaches who helped install that system, because they've all gone on to other jobs, I think it makes me rethink Rob Manfred in a lot of ways, because I thought he was just your classic management tool. And in most cases, I think he still is, but in this one, I think there were enough other teams that were just pissed off enough at the Astros that they went to him and said, you take care of this. It's a little bit like what the mandate was for Adam Silver when he announced the hammering of the LA Clippers and Don Sterling.
It's almost like they just turned around to Crane and said, you need to do something more. And if they're saying that to him, they're saying it to the...
I think they offered that to Crane. I said, do you want to be on the right side of this or the wrong side? Because if you don't fire him, we will. And I think that's how they arranged for this to be. We're suspending him for a year, and then Crane got to come in and be the example of moral rectitude that he's never been before.
By the way, Ray didn't say that any manager got suspended because he was a felon. That was Steinbrenner.
Yes, who was guilty of a felony.
Ange in Oakland, we got 1 minute, Ange. I gave this to you. Again, anyone who just wants to tell me, like, oh, you're nuts for picking the Titans over the Ravens. Look, nuts happens in sports. Upsets everywhere. They didn't stay Frosty, Ange. They didn't stay Richard Sherman.
Hey, man. Hey, I had to pull out two, not one, for them. They didn't have no plan B, man. And Tennessee did exactly what they were supposed to do, which was run that ball right down their throat. You know what I mean? That's why I told you Friday I wasn't looking for the Super Bowl. I just wanted one game, bruh. One game. They couldn't get that to me. But they gave me a good season, man. I wasn't looking for the season we had based on that boy wasn't a throw at the ball last year.
Put it this way. At the end of last year, they were saying, I wonder if this guy's your quarterback. There's no doubt in that anymore. Ange, we got a boogeyman. We'll talk to you later this week. Thanks to all of you for talking to us today. Thanks to Jason Lockenfora, Michael Irvin, and Peter King. Want you to stick around. We got Covey and Shasky, a little butcher shop coming up next. In the meantime, Albie Nash, thank you both. We're back tomorrow. Hopefully Matt's feeling better. Sports don't build character. They reveal it.
And like that, he's gone.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.